you as the person receiving the money carry out your own DD so you don't go and have problems in the future. Fairly recently, you know, someone had reached out and they have gone to take a certain amount of money, lesser than 50k USD for 80% of their company. If you know you can't handle the pressure, then don't get into that deal with them. If you know you don't want to become an employee in your own company, then don't get into that deal with them. So I say to people, right, you're not an island. You probably have a friend that's a lawyer. You can reach out to them. But again, I also say, reach out to someone who, oh, that's literally what they do.
Let's start out with an introduction. Let our audience meet you. Tell them who you are.
Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, because I don't know when you'd be listening to this podcast. My name is Karen Chukwu. I'm the managing partner of Catwig & Dale. We're a tech law firm. We provide legal services to startups, investors, individuals within the African ecosystem. The goal every day really is to build Africa's economy, one startup or one business at a time.
Okay, so how long have you been running Catwig & Dale? When did you start?
Started in 2021.
Okay, that's about 2 years or so. Okay, almost 2 years. So why did you, I mean, you were not always a startup lawyer. So why did you leave?
Well, I'm a tech and IP lawyer, actually.
Right. So why focus on tech and IP?
I just loved it, to be honest. When I finished uni, when I wanted to specialize, I thought about technology and intellectual property. And so I just wanted to focus on it. Although my dad didn't think that was a great idea. He actually thought I should go into either energy or maritime. Typical African parents. And I don't even blame him. I mean, when you're done paying tuition in pounds, you better bring home the money.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay. So let's do a little crash course of venture capital. Not everyone would understand what venture capital is. So can you just explain? What is it first, and why would any startup need a lawyer in the process?
Oh, okay. So in simple terms, right, when we speak about capital, it's the money that you use for your business, right? So venture capital is pretty much just money that you need for your startup. Like, that's as simple as I can put it, right? It's a form of private equity. You get funding from, you know, a capitalist firm, a venture capitalist firm, stroke investors that you put into, you know, your business, running it, building the product, marketing, whatever. But it's that money that you need, especially when you start out, because you need to scale. And in all honesty, there's this, I would call it a phrase that people use very often in this part of the world, where they say you need money to make money. It's pretty much capital for your business. Startups needing lawyers during the process. I mean, I would definitely say it's not just required for that process alone. It's required for everything. The reason why lawyers are needed in that process, like you asked, is because, I mean, you're taking money from people, right? And nobody's going to give you free money. It's not a grant. You need to understand the terms, you know, at which you're being given the funds. You need to understand the implications as well, not just short term but long term. And you would definitely need a lawyer on board to obviously go through the agreements, you know, advise you on whether or not to bite or to not bite, help you as well with, you know, the due diligence. Because I mean, you find in raising funds, you find that the venture capital firms are the ones that actually carry out DD, right? But I always advise you as the person receiving the money, carry out your own DD so you don't go and have problems in the future. Okay. And so you need a lawyer to obviously do that for you, because there's a limit to which you would be looking for, searching for, and there's a limit to which you can go as a founder in finding those informations as well as that you need to decide whether or not to take a deal or to not take a deal.
Okay, so speaking of them, so what are... Just give me three terms that every founder should know once they start speaking with investors and probably get their first term sheet.
Terms.
I mean, there's
a
lot.
You definitely want to understand how much equity you're giving out to the investor who is obviously, you know, putting capital or funding into your business. You want to know how much equity you're giving out. You want to understand the shares that you'll be holding on to as well. Ordinary preference, which one? You also want to understand the amount of control that you'd be giving, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, them holding equity is one thing and them having control is another. You find that some investors pretty much want a board seat, you know, on your board. They want to be able to get their hands dirty. They want the hands-on control. And so you want to understand these things, not because, you know, it's a bad thing to allow them control, but because it can change some things for you. And when we're looking at things legally, it can actually alter the growth of your business or the trajectory of your business, especially when you have certain level of hands-on control. So definitely look out for this, because you find people, you know, taking some money and giving out a whole lot of equity, and you pretty much make yourself an employee in your own company. So yeah, definitely look out for that.
All right, what are some common mistakes you've seen founders make when they're trying to raise money, like legal mistakes? Now,
not doing their own DD is one mistake.
Let's stop with that and let's expand on that. What kind of due diligence are we talking about on the founder side?
I mean, you want to understand the kind of businesses they have invested in the past. You want to understand their expertise as well in your field, in your whatever industry you're playing in, because that comes in handy. I'll give an example. If you are a health tech, is any member of the management team, does anybody on their team, you know, have experience either in the health industry or something? Because that would come in handy. Or do they have, you know, access to other people that could actually assist you or help you grow? There's that. You definitely want to know the percentages in terms of equity that they typically ask for as well. You want to look into the other companies that they've actually put money into and how they have just grown in the years that they have been in business for. And you also want to understand the people that you'll be working with as well. You find that some people put money in your business and they're so mean, in quotes. And, you know, for some founders who are trying to obviously scale and they're still trying to learn on the job, etc., it can be difficult as well. But when you look outside that, right, you definitely want to look at their relationship in general. Do these guys take advantage of businesses like ours? Do they take advantage of businesses within my jurisdiction or within my continent, right? Things like that. You definitely want to know that because it saves you the problems that you probably encounter in the future. I mean, you find that when people get funding from some VC firms, you find that some things change for them. Because these guys, nobody's giving you money for free. They definitely want to obviously make profit on the investment, right? And so there's so much pressure. If you know you can't handle the pressure, then don't get into that deal with them. If you know you don't want to become an employee in your own company, then don't get into that deal with them. So different strokes for different folks, pretty much.
Okay, so let's do something. I'll create a scenario. So I have an edtech startup and we are improving access to education for, well, everybody's doing K-12, so let's do secondary school in Nigeria. I'm a pre-seed startup. How much equity should I be giving out at the pre-seed stage?
Okay, so I can't advise on equity because there's so many factors to weigh in, right? But then when you talk about pre-seed, now let's look at it from the investor's point of view and from you, the founder, right? From the investor's point of view, yes, they probably see that your business idea is great. You might actually scale in a few years. But then again, that's actually the most risky point to actually put money in your pre-seed, because you've not actually seen the final product. You don't know if it's going to work. You haven't worked with these guys before. You don't understand their drive. So as an investor, you're a bit wary. And different firms have different percentages in terms of what they're looking to take. Some ask for 8%, some ask for 20%, I've heard a ridiculous 50% of the company, but let's not get into that. And then on the part of the founder, right, you're probably sold on this idea. So again, I always say, look at the big picture. Look at the people you're looking to work with. I never advise any of my clients to give out a huge chunk of equity to an investor, because that's just pre-seed. That's just pre-seed. We've not even gone anywhere. I mean, I understand that the people who hold equity would obviously dilute, including the founders, but still, why are you giving out 30% or like 40% at pre-seed stage? Then what would you do at seed? What about the people who have worked for you and have helped your startup, you know, grow to a certain point? What are the stock options available to them at that point by the time you give out a huge chunk? So these are things to consider as well. Again, there could also be a cap as to where that VC firm could actually take you to, right? Mm-hmm. There could be a cap, and once you get to that ceiling, you start, you know, obviously looking dreading the exact, you have to look for others, and then you start to dread the earlier decision that you made. So
okay, so speaking of employees and giving them stock options in your company, mm-hmm. how can a founder go about that? So it's not a very common practice in Nigeria or in Africa generally, and a founder may probably want to do that, but he's not exactly sure how to go about it. So what's the best way to go about it?
I mean, so if you were going to register somewhere else, there are options for that, maybe in the US and the UK, there are options to actually leave certain percentage, you know, of the stocks available. Just, you know, have them allocated for, you know, stock options. There's that option. If you are just in Nigerian entity, right? Well, as of, I think that ended last year. Before, you could actually leave some percentages for, you know, stock options, but then again, agreements, you know, are pretty much binding. And so if you have, you know, employees that you want to have access, you know, to stocks, etc., agreements, I mean, there's obviously a board resolution that approves certain number of stocks for such employees, and then there are agreements that are binding and like policy plans, etc. So that's actually how you go about it if you were just a Nigerian entity.
Okay.
Even if you were a US entity and you probably registered and didn't leave, you know, a certain percentage for your employees, agreements are always binding, and they also overrule earlier agreements as well if expressly stated. So okay. It's not a problem. It's just a whole lot of drafting work.
I'm more work for the lawyers then.
Yeah.
Okay. So intellectual property is one of your strong areas. A lot of startups would also have like intellectual property. And I don't know if you've seen this conversation, but I've seen a few founders say, why should I send you my deck? There could be sensitive information there. Mm-hmm. And some people are actually skeptical of just sharing your ideas, mm-hmm. because they feel that they could... someone else could take the idea and mm-hmm. run with it. So how can startups protect their intellectual property when looking for venture capital?
Depending on the stage when you actually go out to source for funds. I mean, if you're very, if you're still idea stage, then I would take it that there's probably no funds, or you're still bootstrapping, and you find that a lot of them haven't even done as little as, you know, protecting their trademark, right? Your question was how to protect it. Okay, so let me start by explaining. So the types of IP rights. So you have your copyright, your trademark, your patent, you know, geographical indications, you know, trade secrets.
Can you explain all of that? So
okay, so for the purpose of startups, right? So you have your copyrights on, you know, literary works, artistic works, so paintings, writings, etc., right? You know, down to lyrics and all of that. And you have your trademark. So trademark is, let me give an example, Tech Point Africa. That's your trademark, the name, that slogan, Stories That Matter, and then the logo, okay. Right? Now, Tech Point was probably registered as Tech Point Technology something, something, something. Not everybody, you know, is going to want to call you that full name.
Yeah.
Now, when you go into the market, this is what they see. This is what they assign to your brand. This is your brand, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So that's what trademark is. So if you were running a business, TechPoint Africa, that is your trademark and you have to protect it, right? So you apply and you go through all of the phases. It's published in the Gazette, well, 4 times a year, that is per quarter. And then you get your certificate that actually shows that you hold the trademark over this. Now, someone else can't use it. That's the good thing about IP rights. And if they were to use it, they would have to obviously seek consent from you, right? And then patents. Patents are for novel ideas. So something that has not been done before. It has never been a new invention or whatever. I mean, you could also even replicate the steps in someone else's work, but then the end work is a new thing entirely. You can go to patent it and you hold the rights over that for 20 years. And if anybody wanted to probably produce the same thing, they would come to seek, you know, for that license to be able to actually use your own patent to, you know, produce their own thing. So you typically find that, you know, within the pharmaceutical industry, etc., which is why you see so many different pharmaceutical companies producing the same drug, maybe like a paracetamol, for example. Exactly. So one person had the patent, and for other people to, you know, produce, they had to go get that license to be able to do that from the patent holder. Now, for trade secrets, right? So these are, you know, confidential information that help your business thrive, and you want to be able to protect it, which is why you see people shooting out NDAs here and there, right? They're trying to protect those things. And I mean, you can't blame people that are a bit skeptical about sharing their stuff, because again, the thing with the startup space is whoever has access to funds, resources in general, because resources refer to money, the creative minds, etc., they can take your idea and they can scale it. It's, you know, it's not a problem. And so the advice, what was your question again?
How do they go about protecting their IP?
Okay, good. Now, it depends on what you're trying to protect. Many people are not coming up with novel ideas that can be patented. Let's be very honest, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in the fintech space, you'd actually see some ideas coming out, I mean, within this year, next year, and, you know, future years, where they're probably going to, you know, change the mode of payment, etc. And they'll be moving to actually patent those steps or the final invention, etc. But for now, it's pretty much your trade secrets, copyright, your trademark, right? And to protect this, definitely approach an IP lawyer. They would provide advice. Now, the thing with, I mean, before they even go ahead to, let's use trademark as an example, because it's very popular. Everybody's logo tells a story. Their name tells a story, right? Before they would go ahead to, you know, make a move to actually register that IP, which is a trademark, they will need to provide advisory, because the truth is, not every name will fly at the trademark registry.
Okay. What does that mean?
Now, it has to be something that is not... There are some names that they may say, oh, this can be used in a sentence, right? It's very generic. And then they'll say, oh no, we can't approve this. You know, imagine if I went to trademark Apple, right? I mean, they're different. I mean, you would have to pair that, you know,
with something else.
Exactly. To make your application straightforward and easy as possible, or else you would keep getting rejected and then you'd have to go back again and all of that. There is that, right? And then there is also understanding that with trademarks, there are different classes, right? So I could actually trademark TechPoint Africa under class 41 and maybe 35. And someone else can trademark it in class 2 and class 3. Okay. Different classes cover different uses, you know, industries, etc. Now, let me give an example. Let's say class 1 is to be used for stationaries, right? And let's say class 7 is used for healthcare products. Now, this is not what the actual classes are, but this is just an example. Now, if I was running a stationary company and I wanted to trademark, you know, the name Karen Stationaries or Karen Appleby Stationery, right? I would be going to class 1 to, you know, obviously trademark to protect it under class 1. Now, what that means is if there was another stationery company that wanted to trademark current something stationery, they wouldn't be able to do that under that class, because now I hold the trademark under that class. So when people, when you hear someone say, oh, I have the trademark over TechPoint Africa, it's not for all the classes. Do them if you easy. If you want to, it's not for all the classes. You have to do it for the classes where you actually operate within, which means that that space, someone else cannot come in and use, you know, that particular trademark, that logo, that slogan within that space, within that class. That's why you can see something like, what example do I give now without outing something? Because I actually want to give an example that people will definitely understand. I came across something the other day. Actually, Glow, under Glow, there's something called Bumper Balance. I don't know if you're okay, aware. Yeah. And there's a new bank, there's a bank, not a new bank, but there's a bank that also uses that term as well, bumper something. But there's also a product, Bumper, right? Now, obviously, Bumper has trademarked under a certain number of classes, right? Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Glow as well. They've gone to trademark whatever their Bumper Balance under, if they have anyways, under a certain number of classes. But you can see that they're not going to clash. And they both would have that trademark.
In but different classes.
Exactly. Now, if Glow were to say, oh no, we don't just want to be a telecommunications company, we probably want to come into the e-commerce space, and they wouldn't be able to trademark Bumper, maybe, or maybe Bumper Balance under the same class as that of as the classes that Bumper has trademarked under.
Okay.
Because now you hold that, it's yours.
So something I've seen is it's usually in the fintech space. So I've seen where across different geographies. So let's use Wema. There's a Nigerian bank. But let's say there's Wema in Nigeria. And then you go to Kenya, there's a Wema. Mm-hmm. Go to Pakistan, there's a Wema. And then you go to Portugal, there's a Wema. Mm-hmm. Would that ever be an issue for a startup if they decide to maybe expand into these countries?
Okay, so IP rights are based on jurisdiction. If I hold it here in Nigeria, it doesn't mean it extends to Ghana or to Sierra Leone, right? However, I failed to mention this. Now, there's an organization called the World Intellectual Property Organization, and Nigeria actually signed that treaty. But yeah, if you were going to actually, you would have to go all the way to Ghana, and it's a very long process. But let's not talk about the things that we do as Nigerians. Under this organization, and by virtue of the treaty, you're able to register your intellectual property in one member state, and it covers across the other member states. Now, it's a very expensive process. Okay. Very expensive, because now there are about 163 or 68 member states. So imagine, you know, having a worldwide coverage for your IP rights. It means that once you protect, let's say, once I trademark TechPoint Africa under WIPO, it's going to apply in all the other member states in the classes that I've registered TechPoint Africa under, right?
Yeah.
You find that most multinational companies use it. Most multinational pharmaceutical companies as well, or maybe STEM-related industries or companies rather, use it to ensure that, you know, what they're protecting in this country is obviously being protected in the other country, yada yada yada. It's good, but I mean, it's not for startup level. It depends on your level. And I think that by the time you're either getting to IPO stage, then you're probably ready for it, because I mean, there are probably several milestones that you must have hit, and you probably expanded into a couple of other countries where your product is, and you probably want to protect it. So I would definitely say give it a go. Go ahead and, you know, register under WIPO. But if you haven't gotten to that point, please play within this jurisdiction.
Okay. All right. So this is probably, we're probably like going back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
What does the typical process look like from the point where I decide to get money from VCs to the point where we close the deal? What's that process like from a legal perspective?
The process like from a legal perspective? Well, there is legal perspective, there's a whole lot of documents, because I mean, these guys are carrying out DD on you. So you need to ensure that you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's. That would definitely be the point where you start seeing some founders say, hey, there was no founders agreement. Hey, we did not do this. We did not do that, right? Or we don't have employee contracts. And, you know, during that process, they're looking into your data room. They want to see the agreement you've executed. They want to see if you're incorporated, etc. And now it depends on the stage, right? And obviously, the higher you go, the most amount of money you're able to get, because it's a risk investing, you know, in a company, and you have to be compliant as much as possible. Especially when you play in a heavily regulated industry, they're looking out to see that you have the requisite licenses or the requisite permits before they eventually put any money in there. So for the lawyers, you know, back end, there's so many documents that we need to draft, legal documents, agreements, etc. That's for, well, they haven't done those. That's why we step in to get these things ready. There's definitely reviewing the term sheet as well and seeing that the terms within are fair, although it's not legally binding, but then they pull those informations into the actual final agreement that you'll be signing, right? So you need to ensure that they're fair. Do you want to give out more than one board seat to, you know, this firm? Why are you giving out board seat for maybe $25,000 USD? Like, you get what I'm trying to say? So these are things that you obviously have to, you know, look at. But on our own end, it can be a hectic process for startups that have not done some of the necessary preliminary steps that they should have taken when they started. And it depends on the stage that they're at as well.
So considering all this work that needs to be done, how early should I be hiring lawyer for a startup?
Very early, actually, because I say to people, I mean, I understand that, you know, lots of founders say, oh no, legal, let's not really get into it. But then you get yourself in a very messy situation. And if you come to me, my dear, you're going to fund my next trip. I'm being real, because it is very hectic trying to get some people out of some situations. Let's not even talk about negotiations. There's definitely the strategy. I know my partners and I have to get on several strategy calls, try to find out ways to, you know, go around things to get them back to a good point. And I always say to people, you could have easily not had this problem. It's definitely not a smooth ride for any business, but there are some problems that trying to regularize it becomes even more tedious if you had tried to do it from the beginning. So fairly recently, you know, someone had reached out and they have gone to take a certain amount of money, lesser than $50,000 USD, for 80% of their company.
I've seen terms like that.
I didn't even know whether to laugh, because I know I wouldn't do that, or to cry, because this person obviously didn't know what was going on. That's why I kept making that the free, or saying, want to become an employee in your own company, 80%. And some of these people don't, you know, a founder isn't as knowledgeable as many people might try to say that they are. They have a great idea, yes, but then they're trying to build, right? And sometimes they might not be focused on the other things, which is a problem. Now you get a lawyer on your team who's, you know, able to look at some things, review some situations, even carry out a risk assessment. Because, I mean, in practice, there's several things that you see, and you're able to say, ah, if you do it like this, when you get to this point, you'll be in soup. I've seen this happen in the past, so let's not do it like that. Let's do it this way, right? It's very, very easy to not make those mistakes. But again, it is also very easy to make the mistakes, and I don't actually blame them. But I would say where I blame people is where, you know, is when they just say, oh no, it's legal. Some people have said that to me, it's legal, so we just left it. Okay, good for you then.
So something a lot of people do, you just mentioned it, is they leave, the not so important, in quotes, mm-hmm. aspects of their business. So maybe they don't focus so much on marketing or sales. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't focus on the legal aspect. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you ask them, they say it's because of how much it costs. So they would not want to hire an expert mm-hmm. at the early stages, because they think, oh, that's money that we can't really afford to spend. But sometimes these decisions come back to bite them in the future. So for lawyers or for startup founders, how can they ensure that they have one very good legal personnel working with them from the early stages and without maybe overextending their budget, but something on a very, let's just say I don't have enough money, because like the example you gave, the person who took 50K for 80%
less than 50K
for 80% of his company obviously didn't have a lot of choices, and that's why he felt that was an okay deal to take. So for someone like that, maybe one of the reasons they did that was because they didn't consult a lawyer, or they didn't even want to, or they didn't feel it was necessary. So considering how important this is, how can founders ensure that, oh, we have a lawyer from the very early stages?
To be honest, I don't know. I'll just tell you, maybe reach out to Kat Wigandale.
Okay.
But I mean, definitely. So I say to people, right, you're not an island. You probably have a friend that's a lawyer. You can reach out to them. But again, I also say, reach out to someone who, oh, that's literally what they do. That's their own niche. Because I think it was last year, someone said that some lawyers prevent them from doing some kind of things. And I was like, please, who did they go to meet? Because you can't meet a property law lawyer and expect them to give you services of a startup lawyer or an IP lawyer. It's definitely not going to work, right? And so I would definitely say, for like your smaller deals, maybe reach out to your friends, family who are trained, qualified lawyers, if you're worried about the cost. Or you can reach out to Kat Wigandale. You can just choose it. make a choice.
All right, so you've heard that, you can always go over to the website and book an appointment. Just keep the money for our next trip ready.
Wow.
So, yeah, let's talk about corporate governance. It's a big deal right now. Maybe not in the past, but it's currently a big deal in Africa. Mm-hmm. How can startups, especially early stage startups, so I'm more focused on early stage startups, because I think the bigger a business gets and the older they get, it should be common sense that you have corporate governance. But I may not know what corporate governance is as a first-time founder who is just maybe 21. Probably don't know what that is. So how can I ensure I have the best form of corporate governance for the level I'm operating at?
Like you said, the bigger they get, then it starts to get more important for them each day. But again, you find that there's something called a company secretary, right? Yeah. These guys come in and they ensure that everything in terms of, you know, the corporate governance, company secretarial works, etc., everything is airtight, right? So I'll definitely say just approach one and get that sorted. Again, so much for really early stage guys, right? When VC firms are trying to, you know, put money into that, they look at it, right? But they don't really make a fuss about it. But then by the time you start climbing, you definitely need to get things under control. Because when everything is not done right, the corporate veil will be taken off. Then they will come for you, the founder. Because people always say, oh yeah, it's a company, so nothing. If anything happens, okay, don't worry. So definitely approach a lawyer to help you with everything. It's straightforward, really. It's really straightforward. I mean, there's definitely going to be a board, the board of directors that obviously, you know, manage the affairs. There's certain decisions that have to be made at board level, right? Ensure that those decisions are made at board level and obviously documented, which is why when I spoke about the employee stock options, I made mention of a board resolution, because you can't do some things and then say, oh yeah, it's going to fly. If you're looking at that, everything has to, you know, pass through the proper channels down, etc. But then when you talk about startups again, there is no time for proper channels, I understand, right? Which is why I said it depends on their stage, because certain things start to get more important when you start getting to a certain, you know, point, maybe expansion, etc., right? But the basic things, ensure that, you know, whatever decisions you've made have been properly documented, ensure that you have the right agreements with your employees, etc. ensure that you just have a lawyer on board, really. It's really helpful to get one on board.
Okay, so
thank you so much for your time.
Never spoke about compliance, which is very, very important.
Let's do that then.
And so just one thing to add about compliance, different industries, different levels of, you know, compliance required. But then when you talk about funds, right, coming in, especially
from foreign companies.
Exactly. You know, there is that. Okay, let's talk about two types of startups. The ones that have registered here in Nigeria and the ones that have like parent companies somewhere else, right? So they'll probably get funds to their parent company and then they'll have to bring it in. And all of those things have to be properly documented and of course reported to the necessary bodies. There is that, right? There is getting a document from the bank that shows how much has been received, etc. There is also ensuring it's a new startup act. Oh my goodness. That's the most basic level of compliance, but we actually don't. But yeah, if you were sourcing for fund as a founder, definitely do that. Weigh your risks. Carry out your own due diligence on these firms as well. Don't just go with anybody because you're looking for money. Do your own research. Work with the best people because the best people would actually get you from point A to point B or prevent you from getting from point A to point B. There's no two ways about it. You can have someone's money and they can sort of like stifle your growth, you know, trajectory, etc. Especially when there's so much control. But then again, you also need these guys because they have the experience most times. They have the access as well to, you know, other people that can definitely help your business thrive or grow in whatever market it is, right? But always ensure that before you sign any documents, get a lawyer on board, get your lawyer on board to discuss the terms, and do not look down on yourself or your business idea. If one person doesn't fund it, another person will fund it as long as, you know, you're able to do the work. That's just it. So if you miss out on one opportunity, there are 1,000 more opportunities out there. So definitely continue bootstrapping until you find the right opportunity. Good luck. Your building process or journey.
Okay. So how about if I wanted to expand to a different country? Different legal requirements. So how do I go about getting a lawyer?
Just approach Katwig and deal if you want to expand to Ghana or Rwanda.
Okay, those are
just putting it out there.
Okay.
Yeah, so definitely like different countries, different legal requirements. Some countries require you to have a certain percentage of your workforce as citizens. Some require you to have a co-founder who is a citizen. So okay, these are things that obviously like the founders will have the highest percentage.
So what if I don't have one? Like I'm a Nigerian and I already have one co-founder. He's Nigerian as mm-hmm. well. And I'm expanding into, let's say, Zambia. Mm-hmm. Is there a workaround? So for example, can I do a country manager instead?
There's always a workaround. That's why we're lawyers. Shebi will read it. When we read the surface, we'll then read underneath. Reading between the lines, there is always an exception to every rule and there's always a way to go about something. And I'm not saying that the going about it is illegal. No, it's being able to, you know, pull things apart, understand each, you know, piece of the puzzle and then put it back and then, you know, bring it forth to maybe the regulatory bodies and say, oh, this is what you said here, but are you aware that this thing that you said here then means that this can happen? Are we good now? Mm-hmm. Then you get away with it. So you see, just always get a lawyer to definitely assist you. It helps to also have someone on ground, someone who has done business in that country, not because they'll be helping you with the legal needs, but just helping you understand the market better. Because some people expand into some places and then they realize that was a very bad move. So definitely have these two people, very, very important. Have your lawyer, have your business dev manager or something that can explain the market and the needs to you properly.
All right. So thank you so much for your time. This was I think this was like a masterclass on legal requirements for startups. Mm. So Don't worry, you can't charge for it because you're on our podcast, so you can't charge for it. But yeah, thank you so much for coming around. I think you'll do a part two. I can't promise, but I think we should do a part two some other time. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. And again, good luck on your building journey.
All right.
That's it for today's episode of Equity Merchants. Please like, subscribe, and share the podcast.